You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniele Friberincini. Ciao, come stai?
Not bad. You've been revising. How's it going?
Preparation. I think this was my final week being allowed to call you that, Daniel, so I made sure that I...
No, last week was the last week.
Are we into penalties now? We're into financial penalties for this.
Apologies.
Sin bin.
Apologies. How are you, Daniel?
Yeah, fine. What about you?
Well, we're just freezing a little bit here on the banks of the Thames, aren't we, Lionel?
We are. I'm sitting very awkwardly because there's some bird poo on the table, which I'm trying to keep my laptop out of.
Yeah.
I don't want to paint a picture that we record the podcast in luxury.
Well, that's certainly not the case. We are in late October, aren't we? Is it November soon?
It is. November on Friday, Richard. A few days' time. When we'll be at the Ruler Classic on Friday.
Well remembered, Lionel. On Friday, still tickets available, I believe. November the 1st, the Ruler Classic. Myself, Lionel, and Francois Tomazo on Friday evening. Go to rulerclassic.cc for tickets.
Yeah, we're on after Greg LeMond and Phil Anderson. And if you think of the lineup of the Ruler Classic, a bit like a kind of Glastonbury lineup, we're in a pretty good slot there. Hopper 6 on Friday evening after LeMond and Phil Anderson. Obviously, the arena will empty out after they've been on.
Imagine if, you know, 14-year-old Lionel Burney, little Lionel Burney in his Watford shirt, playing as Sabutio, maybe watching the Tour de France on teletext. Imagine if you'd been told that in 20-odd years, 30 years' time, there'd be an event called the Ruler Classic in London, and it would be a celebration of professional road cycling, and you would...
And Lionel Burney would be
and
there.
And you'd be on the bill with Phil Anderson and Greg LeMond.
When you put it like...
Change sports, isn't it?
When you put it like that, Richard, it's pretty remarkable, isn't it? Yeah. 14-year-old Lionel Burney would be absolutely
cock-a-hoop
about that. What has happened to 44-year-old Lionel Burney in the 30 years since?
Well, that's what we'll be talking about on Friday, Lionel. Didn't tell you. We're doing a sort of This Is Your Life type show, aren't we? No, we're not.
No, we're not.
We're not. But it'll be a nice warm-up for our own Grand Tour coming up in November. Tickets still available for that at thecyclingpodcast.com. Bristol, Cardiff, Worcester, Dublin, Belfast, London,
Cambridge,
Edinburgh, Leicester, and Manchester. In London, on the 18th of November, we'll be joined by Matt White. And on the 25th of November, we'll be joined by Adam Blythe, who is also joining us in Manchester on the 30th of November.
But we kick off in Bristol, the Grand Départ for our Grand Tour, with myself and Richard and Orla Chenoui and Francois Tomazo. Very much looking forward to it. The show is kind of taking place a little bit now, and will do so even more when our book arrives from the printers at the end of the week.
The book, The Grand Tour Diaries, is out very soon. Fantastic Christmas present. You can pre-order it for the shows at thecyclingpodcast.com for just £12, or you can buy it for £15, which is its recommended retail price. At our website as well, thecyclingpodcast.com. The Grand Tour Diaries, that's all our diaries from the 2018 and 2019 Grand Tours and the Women's Tour. So lots to look forward to. I think Belfast is very close to selling out now, isn't it? Just a few tickets left for Belfast.
And I think Edinburgh's doing very well as well. Makes me think that's Belfast, Orla's home event, and Edinburgh, your home event, Richard. Perhaps we should have added Watford or not Watford.
And Coventry. Sorry, Daniel. Maybe next year. Anyway, what's been happening in the world of cycling, Lionel Burney?
Well, Richard, the big news that was confirmed last week was something we'd been anticipating really since the Tour de France, which was that Mark Cavendish will join Bahrain Merida next season, a deal which also includes McLaren, which, of course, owns a stake of the Bahrain Merida team. We'll talk about Mark Cavendish's transfer from Dimension Data to Bahrain Merida in the first part of the podcast. Cavendish has been in action on the track at the London 6 Day. He was partnering Owain Doull, and they were leading going into the final day, but they were overtaken by the eventual winners Elia Viviani and Simone Consone of Italy. That's the third time that Cavendish has been a runner-up at the London Six, previously partnering Bradley Wiggins and Peter Kenick, and this time with Owain Doull. More kind of fun end-of-season exhibition racing out in Japan, the Saitama Criterium, which was won by Yukiya Arashiro of Bahrain Merida, funnily enough, ahead of...
He's also retiring, isn't he, Nepal? Yeah, I found out. That was his last race.
Indeed. Ahead of Tour de France champion Egan Bernal and Vuelta a España champion Primoz Roglic. I mean, far be it for me to say that they let Arashiro win the race there, but it was a very fitting result.
Oh, very fitting. Very fitting.
Another news flash, chaps. I understand Rog is 30 today.
It's Rog's birthday.
He only turned professional 10 minutes ago, didn't he?
Well, I don't know whether you saw any of the pictures and the film that came out of the warm-up to the Saitama Criterium. Did you see the riders practicing karate? I nearly said karaoke, which is another Japanese thing, but no, karate is the martial art. And something that really caught my eye was the football darts. Did you see that? Rog scored a treble 19 with his kick.
He's not going to swap sports again, is he?
Of course he did.
I mean, he's so versatile,
isn't
he?
So versatile.
Football darts. I mean, well, if you've listened to a...
Speed golf next.
Well, I was going to say...
That's my territory. You hands off, Rog.
Well, cycling and darts, if you listen to Ned Bolting's rival podcast, for a plug for Ned's podcast, I was on that recently. We played a few darts in a pub in Harrogate during the World Championship and talked about, I'm trying to create a new sport called pedal darts, but I asked on Twitter for some way to make cycling and darts.
While doing a ski jump on a bike.
Well, people seem to think that what I was suggesting was that people threw darts while cycling. That isn't what I thought. I'm thinking more of a duathlon type event. Anyway, but this will, you know, I'm already trying to set up a world governing body, which will be riven by disputes and fallouts about money, you know, keep it consistent with both cycling and darts that have had checkered histories in terms of their governance. Anyway, on with the news. Chris Froome was supposed to ride at the Saitama Criterium, but decided that he's not quite ready for that just yet. He did go and check out the road race course for next year's Olympic Games, so he still has to have a plate taken out of his knee in a little operation. I say little operation, that sounds like quite a major operation to me, in December, but he will be back in action next season. A couple of political stories which we may return to. I talked a little bit last week about the fallout between the cyclocross world and the UCI. The UCI trying to impose a new 16-race series on cyclocross, and a lot of people within cyclocross not terribly happy about that. Well, the AIGCP, the Association Internationale Groupe Cycliste Professionnel, basically a collection of the pro teams, have written an open letter, an absolutely stinging open letter to the UCI, the world governing body, complaining in really strong terms about the way the UCI is steering the ship at the moment. We will talk about this in the third part, but the headlines appear to be a deep dissatisfaction with the new pro series of races, which is a series below the World Tour. It includes a Tour of Britain, Kerner Brussels Kerner, and a lot of other established stage and one-day races. In all, 54 races, 26 of them stage races, a total of almost 170 days of racing, only seven of which are outside Europe. Seven of the events are from outside Europe. One of those is the new Saudi Tour, which ASO have introduced for 2020. But the Pro Series, presumably being too big and a kind of random and loose collection of races, putting more pressure on the teams. That's one of the objections, as is the imposition of the Classic Series, which from reading the open letter seems to be more of a dispute about the kind of branding of that. Not sure exactly how this is all going to play out.
Substantial old open letter, that, isn't it? I mean, it's well written and it's been through a lot of people, I think, reading it.
Yeah, could have done with a bit of a sub, couldn't it? I mean, yeah, a little bit, but tighten up in places. But, you know,
talking of subbing, chaps, can I sub something I said a few minutes ago? I don't think old Arashiro is retiring. Oh. You think he's riding for Bahrain Merida next year? I put him out to pasture a year early there. No. Sorry.
Oh, well.
Apology. I'm sure he'll accept the apology. And lastly, this
just
is a
word on Arashiro. He was. I have to say that he was one of the riders queuing in Andorra for the cable car down at the Vuelta. And he was the most cheerful guy there, him and Edvald Boasenhagen. Most people were miserable because it had been hailing, it was freezing cold. The riders were queuing up, shivering in their Lycra for cable cars that kept stopping on the way down because they were overloaded. And he was really cheerful, chatting away to people and just a breath of fresh air. So he deserves that win.
Indeed. Indeed. Lastly, big story, which is developing as we speak, so probably can't go into too much definitive detail, but the medical hearing into the conduct of the former British cycling doctor Richard Freeman is about to get underway. And, well, the extraordinary development, according to his legal team, is that Freeman is basically going to admit to having told lies in his previous what would you call it, submissions to the hearing, but has now told the truth via a witness statement which was submitted last month. And in that, he apparently has admitted to ordering the banned substance Testogel in May 2011, but denies that the 30 sachets of Testogel were intended for an athlete. Now, as this story is developing, we've just seen that our colleague Matt Lawton, formerly of the Daily Mail, now of the Times, has added something to that, which we will... We'll find out whether or not this is true when the hearing gets underway. But basically, the suggestion is that the Testogel was ordered at the request of Shane Sutton, who was obviously working for British Cycling at the time. So this is a really significant development in this story.
The fastest clothing in the world tour. The home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Ratha in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Thank you very much indeed to our title sponsor, Rafa. And I should give a shout out for the Rafa Thermal Bib Shorts because I was wearing them last week, all week in France. I was riding my bike a lot in the north of France. It was about 14, 15 degrees and they were perfect. Really, really comfortable and just warm enough. That sort of thick kind of thermally material. They used to get a lot of tights made out of that. Used to call it Roubaix.
Training for the Ruler Classic, Rich?
No, just taking advantage of being in the stunning countryside in the north of France, really, and very, very rural, very quiet roads, barely saw a car, lots of dirt riding, not deliberately, but I kept following Google Maps and ending up on dirt roads. And a few years ago, I would have turned around, but now I think it's kind of okay to ride on dirt roads because it's fashionable, isn't it?
It's probably the coolest thing you've done this week.
It's the coolest thing I've done in months. But it was
years, decades.
Oh, come on, easy. It was great fun, and yeah, thoroughly enjoyed that. I do feel a bit fitter as a result. Not as fit as Mark Cavendish, though. Did you see much of the sixth day? Does he look sharp? Does he look fit? Lionel?
It's a question about indoor cycling, so I'm presuming that's...
It's not for you. It's not for you. Hard to tell, isn't it?
It is very hard to tell.
I mean, I watched a bit of it on TV, and it's so strange to see the likes of Viviani and Cavendish, Owen Doull, and Caleb Ewan as well, battling it out on the track, because track sprints are nothing like road sprints. And because, obviously, you're stuck in one gear, you don't... There's not the same jump that riders have, so... Very, very hard to really gauge, you know, just how good Cavendish is at the moment. But he's signed for Bahrain Merida. You wouldn't know from the little video that they released that there's a link with McLaren, would you?
No.
But we think that the link, well, Rod Ellingworth, who's taking over as performance director at the team, is employed by McLaren. We think, it's not been confirmed yet, but we think the team may be Bahrain McLaren or McLaren Bahrain next year. They seem to be assuming a greater role in terms of running the team. And Mark Cavendish appears to be, well, it certainly fits that. He's had a relationship with McLaren for a while. But Daniel, can Rod Ellingworth and Mark Cavendish roll back the years? They started off, of course, at the British Cycling Academy, which Rod Ellingworth ran with great success. He was Cavendish's coach for many years, worked with him extremely closely when he won the World Road Race Championship in Copenhagen in 2011. you know, can they, the sort of old gang were brought together at Dimension Data with Bernard Eisel, Mark Wrench on Cavendish. That didn't really work out. Rolf Aldag as well. Is it going to work out for Cavendish at Barry Merida with Ellingworth?
Well, I don't think I'm breaking any news to anyone when I say that it's Cavendish's last chance. He's 34 at the moment, 35, turns 35 in May. I mean, just looking at his season, I was quite hopeful about what he might achieve this season, and mainly because he seemed to have really sort of reevaluated a lot of things and taken on board that he needed to change things. He did various things that he'd never done before this year. He spent quite a bit of time in Mallorca training. He spent time at altitude training, and you know, sort of, as I say, took on board that he really needed to change his training. I think for a long time, by his own admission, he hasn't varied his training sessions enough. You know, he's one of these guys who tends to go out for sort of 3-4 hours and ride pretty hard. But, you know, even on his easy days, he rides relatively hard. And really, that's not the way most guys train nowadays. It tends to be a lot more sort of differentiated and a lot more specific. But he didn't win a race. It feels like he's ridden quite a lot, but I'm just looking, or he's raced quite a lot this year, but I'm just looking at the number of kilometres he did this year, 8,400. The riders who did the most kilometres this year, around about the 14,000, 15,000 mark. And the last 3 years, Cavendish has ridden 8,400, 6,500, 6,700. So for 3 years now, he's not raced an awful lot.
When did he last finish a Grand Tour? Was it
2015? Was the last time he finished a Grand Tour, which was a tour. Last stage win in a Grand Tour, 2016.
So I mean, you would think that, you know, he was certainly going to next season with a bigger base than he went into this season. And of course, in 2017, in 2018. He suffered with the Epstein-Barr virus and also the previous year. But, you know, whether he can be a factor in the sprints, I don't know. You know, this year there were some mitigating factors, certainly in the team. I mean, Dimension Data as a whole their season was pretty disastrous. His relationship with the management, with Doug Ryder, was not good. Doug Ryder being the team principal. You know, that said, there were other things that improved this year at Dimension Data. Cavendish had been unhappy with his equipment the previous year, certainly in 2018, with the bike. This year they were on a new bike, they were on a BMC bike. There was no issue with that. They had a new kit, they had ASOS kit that he was very happy with, the team was very happy with. So, you know, a lot of things seemed to, or looked as though they were falling into place for him this year. Yet, you know, he wasn't able to get the results that I expected and he would have expected.
How much of the focus next year will be on riding on the track at the Olympic Games, though? Because that we know that has been a goal of Cavendish's in the past. He famously pulled out of the 2008 Tour de France midway through after winning four stages, didn't he, in order to go to the Olympics in China, and it didn't end well for him. Obviously 2012 he was focusing on the road race, but an Olympic gold medal is the one sort of big thing missing from his career.
But it also worked for him in 2016, didn't it? That track focus, that was his best season on the road for a couple of years.
Is that the plan, Daniel?
Well, chaps, my understanding is zero focus will be on that. I think early in the year, there was a point this year where he was considering making that his main focus and possibly even giving up the road in the sort of springtime, around about kind of Paris-Nice time, when that didn't go well for him. But there would be an issue with qualification, and at last check, I think he pretty much parked the idea of even attempting to qualify on the track at the Olympic for the Olympics. But that was, you know, that was sort of latest the latest as of about 3 or 4 months ago.
Interesting then, because at Bahrain Merida, or however they end up branding themselves, he's not taking an entourage of lead out riders or staff, is he? But he is going back home, if you like, to Rod Ellingworth. But he may well be almost freelancing when it comes to the sprints by the looks of it, because quietly Bahrain Merida have put together a pretty decent looking lineup for next year with a few interesting additions. Mikel Landa, Peo Bilbao, Wout Poels bolstering the kind of the GC wing of the team. They've also got Dylan Teuns, of course, who won at La Planche de Belfi at the Tour de France and is continuing to emerge. And your old mate Daniel, fellow Gooner, Marco Haller's going there.
He is, and he actually could be a very useful man, Napalm. If they believe and it looks as though Cavendish can be competitive in the sprints, there's enough firepower to put behind him. I think, you know, Haller will be or could potentially be an extremely useful rider in the lead out. There are guys like Seberg, who's got a lot of experience, who comes sort of earlier in the train. Even people like Heinrich Hausler can be useful. Sonny Colbrelli, of course, is there. I mean, And Phil Bauhaus as well, two sprinters in their own right, neither of whom won a lot this year. But, you know, I think both of them potentially could be redeployed. But, you know, I think the key thing for Cavendish is going to be the communication. The lines of communication with Rod Ellingworth will be open at all times, and will, you know, they'll be open throughout the season. I think that can no longer be an excuse that any... that relationship with the management has broken down. So, you know, it'd be interesting to know, and I'm sure we will find out, I'm sure we'll speak to him in the next few weeks, what Rod Ellingworth's vision for Cavendish's season is, because I'm sure he's got quite forthright opinions on what Cavendish needs to do and what kind of role he can be used in.
I was going to make a cruel comment there, saying enough about the past, what about the future? Moving from Mark Cavendish to Tom Pidcock, but on the off chance that Mark Cavendish might be listening, I'll not say that. But we have got an interview with Tom Pidcock coming up. Now, he's been talked about, well, it seems like for years, as the next big thing. Very versatile rider, very strong cyclocross rider, a bronze medalist in the under 23 World Road Race Championships. He won Junior Paris-Roubaix, and he also won at La Planche des Belles Filles, you know, proper mountain stage at the Tour of Alsace later in the season. He crashed at Tour de l'Avenir and broke his collarbone, so he was out of that race. But a pretty strong season, and a lot of people expected him to move up to World Tour for next year, 2020. He's not doing that. He's staying with a team. Well, Wiggins' team has ended. He's ridden for Team Wiggins the last couple of years. It's come to an end. But he's going to be racing for Trinity Racing, which is a new team set up by Andrew McQuaid, his manager and a well-known agent, looks after lots of riders, Andrew McQuaid. And he's sort of set up this development team with a focus on cyclocross in the winter, but a bit of road focus in the summer as well. So I went recently to the team launch here in London and spoke to Tom Pidcock and to Andrew McQuaid. Here they are now. Tom, we're speaking in October, I think it is. What's the program like for you at the moment? You've just come out of the Worlds. Looking ahead to cyclocross season, what are you doing at the moment?
Well, yes, cyclocross starts on Saturday. I've just come back from holiday. Finished the road season just over a week ago, and so quick turnaround into cyclocross.
How do you structure your season, given that you race, you know, winter, summer? When do you take a break, give yourself some time off?
To be fair, this summer I've had a lot of time off, planned time off and unplanned time off through crashes and illness, and yeah, I had 2 weeks off after the cross season. Then I had 3 weeks off in June, 2.5 weeks or something, and then I've had time off from crashes and then 2 weeks off after having a crash, and then I'm supposed to have a week off here, but I've just, you know, ticked over and holiday ridden and run a bit.
How do you reflect? I mean, focusing on the road season, how do you reflect on your road season? Some, you know, great success, Paris-Roubaix, Alsace, disappointment, Tour de l'Avenir. Taking it all together, how do you assess it?
Well, I guess there's been quite a lot of missed opportunities, but then again, it has also been quite successful. You know, I've won some pretty good races and showed yeah, not some good results.
What would you pick out from those as the highlight?
Well, Yorkshire is definitely the best race of the year. I mean, regardless of result or ever, just being on the start line. And yeah, riding around Harrogate with those crowds, like, felt like every single person was cheering my name. It was quite surreal, really.
And then you ended up with a bronze medal. I mean, the pictures of the podium, you know, your expression was difficult to read. You know, how did you feel after the race and then to learn that you had the bronze medal?
I think I was emotional, but I don't know whether I was happy or disappointed, to be honest. The bronze medal didn't really change much. I mean, after my crash and recovering it, like, mentally, like, I pretty much drained myself, you know, to get on the start line and to be in the form I was in. So I think it was more relief that, like, I was sprinting for the win. And that was sort of a win in itself.
Yeah, I mean, Tour de l'Avenir, I guess, in the original plan, would have been a very important building block towards the Worlds. Yeah. So when you crashed out of that race, when you've been going well, you know, riding really strongly, how did you sort of pick yourself up from that and get yourself back on track for the Worlds?
Well, it was just, I got home, I spent the night in hospital. Well, first of all, I woke up in hospital. I didn't really know what was going on. Then, yeah, the next day I flew home, went straight to the dentist. Well, I saw, and yeah, just took all the steps we could as fast as possible, really. And, yeah, it ended up taking 2 weeks to get back to, well, proper training, really. So, yeah, I mean, it's almost harder, like, recovering from a crash and not even training than it is if you were, you know, doing 4 or 5 hours every day. It's,
mentally, you mean? It was
mentally,
tough.
Mentally, yeah. And then I went to altitude after my knee got infected 3 times. So after the second time of antibiotics, I went up to altitude, and yeah, by after 2 weeks at the end of that, mentally, I didn't have anything. Like, the last effort day, I just didn't have it in me. Mentally, I couldn't do it.
So we're you know, on the brink of the cyclocross season, and that's going to be a big focus for you, I guess, over the next few months. And you're going to be part of a new team that basically replacing Wiggins. Some people expected you to maybe step up to World Tour next year. Was that on the cards? Was it something you thought about quite seriously?
Yeah, it's on the cards, but it wasn't something that I was going to do. I mean, like, I don't think I'm ready to go World Tour. Like,
this year, when you've seen some of the riders, you know, Evenepoel, Pogacar, at your sort of age, riding and winning at that level, have there been moments when you've wondered whether that's the right thing to do?
No, not really. I mean, I think for them, it's right. It's right for them, you know. But for me, I don't need to go World Tour. I don't feel like I want to, and so it's not really. Yeah, my path's different to theirs. So.
I mean, obviously, Van der Poel and Van Aert have highlighted the crossover between cyclocross and road, and obviously they've done really well. Have you been aware that, you know, teams are taking more interest in guys like yourself who are good cyclocross riders?
Yeah, definitely, actually. I think they're certainly switching on to the fact that cyclocross is pretty big, and riders from cross can be pretty good on the road. I think them two especially, some of the cross guys have done well in road races this year. But yeah, I mean, definitely, I think they understand that, yeah, cross riders have a big engine.
Well, what is it? Is it the training? Is it the racing? Is it all the intense efforts you have to make? What do you think it is about cyclocross that equips riders to perform so well on the road?
I think, yeah, probably the intense efforts, because road races, like, they're all pretty long, aren't they? It's endurance, and doing those 1 hour flat out efforts, you know, 30 times in a winter, it's certainly, well, it gives you an extra few percent on the road.
On the road, what would be your main targets next year? World Championships again, but what else?
I think, well, Tour of Yorkshire, Tour of Britain, I definitely want to go well there, and also in the national champs. As for like Lavinia, I don't know whether I'll ride again. I think I might try the Baby Giro. But it's not set in stone, and we still need to discuss it a bit. So
that'd be national team as well. You'd be riding.
No, we can do everything on the road, just not Tour de Yorkshire, Tour de Britain.
Right.
So
okay.
The program will still be pretty much the same as what Wiggins could do.
You know, you're one of these kind of young emerging riders. Do you have a theory why? Because it didn't used to happen in cycling. It used to be guys in their late 20s who were winning the big races. Why are we seeing so many young riders? And Bernal at the Tour, Pogacar, Evenepoel. Why are we seeing young riders win these big races?
To be honest, I don't know. You would have thought that the guys older with the bigger engines, you know, the more miles and like more endurance would be, you know, in winning these Grand Tours and doing well, but... No, I think riders are just coming down from World Tour, and everyone's getting more and more serious every year, and better, and training harder and harder. And I think that's just bringing out talent earlier. I guess I don't really know, to be honest.
I guess the question will be for some of those guys is how do they sustain it over 10, 15, even 15 years?
That is what I am quite interested to see whether like Remco and Pogačar can. I mean, Pogačar's had he's not rushed so much. He has, gone World Tour at the right time. Well, what I think was probably the right time for him. And this year he's just done. Maybe just phenomenally talented. So, and Remco, everyone thought he'd gone too early, and then he's won a World Tour, been the youngest ever winner of a World Tour race. So,
But I suppose in a race, an individual race and in a career, it's all about pacing yourself, isn't it? And you seem to be very aware of the fact that you need to take things at your own pace.
Yeah, I think, I definitely am aware that, you see, you could easily become, the stories of people becoming, quitting who were like world champions and 23 and junior and, I don't want it become a job. It is a job, obviously, but it's not just a job. I still enjoy it, and I don't want to lose that, because then that's when I think you perform your best, when you enjoy it. And if I rush and it all becomes a bit much, then that could possibly happen. So I think it is quite important, and we'll see about the young guys going World Tour, whether that happens to them. But I guess they know what they're doing, don't they?
Tonight is the launch of Trindy Racing, which is actually a continuation of our cyclocross team from last year. So last year we called it TP Racing, which was built around Tom.
Trindy Racing refers to your management company as well. You look after a lot of riders. It's the idea thing, having a development team. It's a great way, I suppose, of finding and looking after young talent. Is this a long-term project?
Yeah, so the way it worked out, it was all a bit last minute last year, and we call it TP Racing because we had nothing else to call it. And then as Tom progressed last year, won everything he needed to in cyclocross, and as he progressed in the road, we realised quite quickly he'll be World Tour eventually. So there's no point keeping a team named after him for cyclocross knowing he was going to go World Tour. So we decided to rebrand it to Trindy Racing. It was also around Tom, it was going to be mountain bike and gravel where he was going to race those races, so he could race for Trindy Racing year round. The sponsor was quite important, sponsors for them to have him year round for those disciplines. If Team Wiggins continued, he would have stayed there, but unfortunately Team Wiggins had to fold for next year, so we were in a bit of a bind. So about literally 3-4 weeks ago, internally we sat down and had a discussion about it. Should we extend this to be a kind of small road club team, so not to replace Team Wiggins, I don't think he can replace it, became one of the best development teams in the world, but this is a place for Tom to race in next year on the road, and also there's about 5 or 6 kind of 18-year-olds coming on board to give them experience, a place to race, and long term, if it becomes sustainable as a development team that us as an agency use to place our guys in to help them grow and develop, then all the better.
So that was Tom Pidcock and Andrew McQuaid. Andrew McQuaid, of course, the man behind Trinity Racing. Tom Pidcock, being their star rider. I think we expect him to move up to the World Tour in 2021. There have been a couple of rumours about potential teams that, would be interested in him. But he does seem to be a young man, and I think this has always been the case, who knows his own mind and is determined to, as he put it, enjoy his racing as much as possible and to do as much. You know, he's talking about doing Dirty Kanza next year. He wants to do as many varied things as he possibly can for as long as possible. And one of the things that happens to any rider when they go to the World Tour is that their focus becomes pretty narrow. So he seems to be wanting to just explore as many avenues as he can, before inevitably ending up in a World Tour team.
Yeah, Rich, there's a lot of hype about Pidcock. Most of it justified, I would suggest. As you say, I think, you know, he's been very versatile and will continue to be, or wants to continue to be very versatile, as he said there in the interview. And I think that will, that should have sort of ensures him against a lot of the pitfalls that, you know, riders who have been hyped in the past and might have fallen into. You know, he's not an American who's coming over with an incredible record in American road races, but oh, we find out when he gets to Europe, he can't, you know, handle a bike, or he doesn't know his way around a bunch. And that's not the case. I mean, Pidcock impressed me at the World Championships in Yorkshire, coming off that injury, you know, with a lot of pressure on him. I don't think, well, he had mishaps in the race as well. And I don't think he necessarily, you know, had the best preparation or the best legs, but he found a way to get himself into contention. I thought almost with sort of through pure will, it looked like on day. And I thought that was pretty impressive. And that said, professional cycling is strewn and littered with former next big things who, you know, have not taken the world by storm in the pro ranks, and success as an under 23 is only really a pointer towards good things when they turn professional. I mean, you have to look at the Palmarès of Paris-Roubaix Espoirs, which Pidcock won this year. Stan De Wolf won it last year. Niels Eckhoff, in 2017. Niels Eckhoff, of course, he initially beat Pidcock, didn't he, in the under 23 worlds, but was then disqualified.
Might still beat him in the courts.
Still beat him. And so you've got names like Mike Toynesen and Bob Jungels, who are obviously doing very well as professionals, but Vermeltfort, he hasn't exactly been racking up the big wins as a professional. Dmitry Kozonchuk, Lucas Spengler.
How far back are you going to go here?
I'm talking about in the last 10 years. 10, 15 years. So, I think Pidcock will know that he can't take anything for granted at this point. And presumably Andrew McQuaid does as well, as his manager.
He's only 20 though, isn't he? And I wonder, probably the temptation to turn professional now, he would be able to do so if he'd wanted to. I'm absolutely sure somebody would have taken him for 2020. Maybe there's some external pressure because of, well, particularly Remco Evenepoel and the way he's done in his first year as a pro for De Koninck Quickstep. I mean, winning the San Sebastian Classic and all the other results that he's had this year, extraordinary. I mean, real, you know, one once in a generation type results for Evenepoel, I would say. But Pidcock is in that bracket, I would suggest, in what he's done at a similar point. He's a little bit older, isn't he? But you could imagine him coming through and having good results straight away. And I wonder if that's actually...
I would slightly take issue with that napalm, the same bracket. I mean, I think Evenepoel is in a bracket of his own. If you look at two things, you know, his last year as a junior, I think, you know, he won the majority of the races he took part in and was second in pretty much all the others that he didn't win. And then, you know, the way he won the World Championships in Innsbruck was pretty unprecedented.
Yeah, but okay.
Yeah, certainly in the bracket below that.
In the bracket below that, then.
But in terms of career, mapping out a career, it reminds me a bit of Mathieu van der Poel, you know, where the versatility is obviously a factor. The the range of interest and talent. You know, Vanderpool is obviously mountain bike, cyclocross and road. Pidcock's in a similar mould in the sense that he's also, you know, following his own path as Van der Poel has done.
Well, that was the point I was going to make, which was that the World Tour teams, in their pursuit, in a way, of Team Sky / Team Ineos, and the ever kind of, the train tracks are getting narrower and closer together, aren't they? The way that success is earned, in particularly in the Grand Tours, has become so specific. Van der Poel is continuing the way he's continuing by remaining outside of the World Tour, staying with Corind and Circus. And so there are perhaps closer parallels with Van der Poel for Pidcock than with Evenepoel. But I kind of applaud that sort of the level-headedness and, in a way, the confidence to say I don't need to rush, I don't need to make a decision, I don't need to jump now. But I'm sure that had he wanted to, he could have done this year.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Stitch Fix. Now, Richard, as I was heading out the door today to come and record the podcast, a delivery arrived, and a very neat box of Stitch Fix clothing, my monthly delivery from Stitch Fix.
It's a box in the shape of a wardrobe.
No, it's not as big as a wardrobe. No, very neatly packed, I think, judging by last month's box. I haven't managed to open it yet. I'm looking forward to opening it when I get home to see what Stitch Fix has sent me. But if you don't know what Stitch Fix does, basically, it's an online personal stylist. Takes the stress and strain out of clothes shopping, something I don't particularly enjoy. When you go to stitchfix.co.uk, you complete a style quiz and you give an idea of, you know, what kind of things you like to wear, sizes, styles. You click on different outfits and say which appeal to you and which don't. And you can also kind of set a parameter of how much of a risk you want to take, how much you want to push the envelope when it comes to your own personal styling. And then you are assigned a personal stylist who will put together a collection of clothes that come through the post each month. And, well, as I said in a recent episode of the Cycling Podcast, I wore my entire outfit at our live event in Harrogate last month, and I'm hoping that this box will contain some gems that I can debut on our tour later.
Did you request?
I did, again, yeah.
Oh,
I made clear that. Yeah, smart, kind of smart casual stuff. So Richard, you're sitting here in a very smart looking jacket, which I'm going to guess you got from Stitch Fix yourself.
Well, why? Because it's quite nice.
It does look very nice.
It is very nice. Yeah, this came in my last box. It's a Ted Baker jacket. I mean, they have it's huge range in terms of, the designers, the make of the clothing, but also the prices. This was at the higher end, I have to say, but it was very nice. When I tried it on, I thought, yeah, I'll have that. It's very nice.
Would you have bought that if you'd seen it in a shop?
I'm not sure. No, probably wouldn't have tried it on in the first place, and it isn't. It wasn't trying it on. It just fit well, and it, you know, I liked it. Do you like it?
I do like it. Looks very nice. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thumbs up for Stitch Fix then. If you'd like to have a go at seeing what your own personal stylist can supply, go to stitchfix.co.uk/cycling. That's stitchfix.co.uk/cycling. And it's stitchfix.co.uk/cycling.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. Went through a lot of Science and Sport products myself last week on the roads of Northern France. Kept all my wrappers.
We're never going to hear the end of this 10-kilometre bike ride you went on, are we?
You obviously don't follow me on Strava then, Daniel.
You're on Strava?
I am, yeah.
Newsflash.
That's the second cool thing Richard's done this week.
Is it cool being on Strava?
I don't know.
It was a
weird thing next week.
I enjoy, because the Tour de France went along a lot of these roads that I was on in 2 years ago, the stage that finished in Amiens, one of the most boring stages of all time, won by Dylan Groenewegen. And so I'm able to compare my times on various sections of the road with some of the riders from the
were
from
they going
tour.
Quicker than you?
I'm also on Arnaud Démare's training roads. He lives nearby and trains around there. Jimmy Casper is local.
Were you reminding yourself of Jacques Anquetil, Rich?
Actually, he's not. He's from not. Well. Yeah, he's not from far away.
You know he's dead now, though. You're not going to bump into him on a training ride.
I was on the road to Rouen at one point last week.
You've got a couple
of
things
play
in common.
Words there. I don't know if anyone
spotted
that.
That's two things you've got in common with Arnaud Démare, then, isn't it? Allegedly.
Holding on to cars. listen, Science and Sport sponsor the cycling podcast, and we're very grateful to them. You can get 25% off your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Now, politics, chaps. Bit of politics.
Hasn't the world had enough politics?
No, never enough politics,
Isn't
Lionel.
Sport...
There's a bit of a pattern emerging in the political landscape around cycling. David Lapartion has been in post now for 2 years, and he seems to be baring his fangs. He does seem to be, if not at war, then at odds with quite a lot of the main, to use an expression I don't really like, stakeholders in cycling. You know, a few weeks ago we covered the fact that Velon, the teams organization, or, you know, they represent 11 of the World Tour teams, or they're owned by 11 of the World Tour teams. They've reported the UCI to the European Commission. Then we've had the letter from the AIGCP, which is the teams association. A very meaty letter complaining about lots of aspects of the way that UCI is running the sport, from the calendar to safety as well. And also this week, we've had an open letter from the Cycling Anti-Doping Foundation, CADF, which is an independent organization that looks after anti-doping on behalf of cycling. And they are in a bit of a pickle because the UCI announced last week that they would be speaking to and having meetings with the International Testing Agency about them taking a greater role in looking after anti-doping and testing, obviously, in cycling. Now, that appeared to be quite a kind of mealy-mouthed, kind of wishy-washy. It was presented by the UCI as just an exploration, really, in other avenues in terms of stepping up the fight against doping. But for the CADF, it is an existential threat, really, because it does seem, and it seems from the ITA's own statement on this, that it could be that the ITA take over anti-doping from the CADF. The UCI will announce the results of its discussion with the ITA when its management committee meets next February in 2020. There would have to be a six-month sort of winding up of the CADF. But this is quite a big story, really, I think, because this is an organization that was set up in 2008 at a time when cycling faced its own existential threat because of the doping crises of 2006, 2007 in particular. And it was a really quite a revolutionary initiative. It's funded mainly by the teams. World Tour teams pay €130,000 a year. The pro teams pay around €88,000 a year. Organizers pay 17% of the prize money from races. And the UCI contribute around about €1 million. And it has an independent board. It became fully independent in 2013 when Brian Cookson became president of the UCI. The board includes people like Rune Anderson, who's been involved in anti-doping in different sports, including IAAF, for many years, and no connection previously with cycling. Andy Parkinson is also a board member. There are five board members in total. Andy Parkinson, now chief executive at British Rowing, used to be the chief executive at UK Anti-Doping. And it's all people who aren't actually intimately connected with the sport of cycling. So it's an independent organization that looks after anti-doping. And cycling has really led the way in sports in having an organization like this. Some others are now following this example by setting up their own independent anti-doping organizations. Now, when I say federations setting up independent anti-doping organizations, that sounds like a bit of an oxymoron, but it does. You know, it can be done if, like I say, the governance is by people who are not connected to the governing body. So, I mean, this was kind of sneaked out last week, this news, but it does. There's a, the pattern that's emerging in all these stories about Velon, AIGCP, and CADF. It looks like David Lapartion is sort of waging war on some of the other stakeholders in cycling, and in particular the teams.
Yeah, Rich. I mean, it just feels like we've just been on a decade-long travelator journey, and we're just sort of coming round to the beginning of the dispute again. Because I've been covering cycling long enough to know that this dispute has been rumbling on in the background, and at various different times, it's ASO versus the UCI. Often it's the teams versus the UCI, or the teams disgruntled with ASO. It's a, you know, the fact of the matter is that there's a squabble that's gone on and rumbled on in the background for probably 20 odd years, with people trying to take control of a larger slice of the cake, without perhaps recognizing that probably the more constructive way forward is for everybody to collaborate together and to kind of stick to their lanes in a way. The UCI here is trying to flex its muscle, and it's a governing body. It's supposed to govern the rules of the sport, the operation of the sport, the safety of the events is certainly within its remit. But other than the World Championships, you know, it's not a race organizer. And the one thing that leapt out at me with the creation of this classic series of one-day races that are part of the World Tour, you can kind of join the dots and see that that's where their objection to Velon calling their series the Hammer Series comes in, because they clearly want to take some kind of control or ownership of the words classic series for branding purposes, perhaps, and perhaps sponsorship purposes. And the suspicion from the teams, I would suspect, would be that the UCI may well be trying to, you know, take make money from the sport without necessarily looking at how those funds can then be shared among the people who take part in the races. And that has been the argument since, you know, the year dot, really. And I just look at the way the UCI has just quietly done one or two of these things, and think they clearly have always wanted to have more of a stake in the actual operation of the elite level of the sport, back to, you know, the organising and running the World Cup series of races, effectively co-opting events that they don't own under an umbrella series. And by creating the World Tour and now a classic series, and then this second tier of racing under the banner of the Pro Series, it seems to me that they're just kind of trying again where they failed numerous times in the past.
I would agree with that, Napalm. You know, and also if you look at, well, this week or today, we've had the news that ASO are going to organise a new race in the Gulf or in the Middle East, the Saudi Tour. And, you know, if we think of the murmurs of David Lapartien being very much beholden to or dictated to by ASO, and you think of, you know, the races that have been put under threat by the appearance of new races, particularly in the Gulf, but over the last few years, all the, you know, the early season Spanish races and Italian races, we hear every year that they're struggling for funding, they're losing days, and, you know, this is a sort of another kind of hostile move, where a discussion about whether it's appropriate to have teams, you know, supporting and essentially promoting Saudi Arabia, given its human rights record, is another one. But if it's the UCI's role to safeguard the heritage of the sport and the values of the sport, and, you know, also core markets of the sport, then you wonder about relationships like that. You also wonder about the UCI's own efforts to organise races in its own right as commercial entities. And then as far as the doping question is concerned, it's all quite nebulous, isn't it? We've spoken a lot over the last two or three years about how difficult it's been to get a handle on what is actually happening as far as testing is concerned, as far as the dimensions of the current dimensions of the doping problem are concerned. And then you get a press release which talks about stepping up the fight against doping, which almost, you know, the wording of the communique almost induces paranoia and makes you think, well, you know, is the UCI concerned that the CADF has not been doing a good job, that there is some kind of epidemic or some kind of problem bubbling under the surface that's now, they feel, getting out of control. And I would suggest that's not the case. This seems to be, again, a bit of a sort of turf war, or you know, there seem to be other interests at play here. The ITA is an organisation based in Lausanne. We think it's, well, it's certainly got strong connections with the IOC. The CADF is based down the road in Aigle, which is, you know, literally 15 kilometres away. But, you know, they've just lost their director, in effect, Francesca Rossi, who's gone to the French anti-doping agency. She's gone to work there. And, you know, the part of the nature of these organisations is that they don't communicate an awful lot. The CADF has communicated very little over the last few years, and you know, it's seen that as important to what it does, but it all leaves the fan, and you know, again, I hate to use that word as well, stakeholders like the fans, slightly uneasy about what's going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, the ITA has only been going about a year. It is a service provider, and it is funded by the IOC entirely at the moment. So, you know, it's very closely aligned to the IOC, and there are some suggestions that, you know, if the UCI throws its lot in with the ITA and basically winds up the CADF, it will be for those political reasons that it's about how closely the UCI and La Partion is dancing to the IOC's tune. And this is always an issue with Olympic sports, you know, to what extent are they beholden to the IOC as well, who are an enormously powerful organization. A little anecdote I was told about the ITA, which I don't think there's a problem with the ITA, you know, it's a young organization, it's doing a lot of good things for some sports, but the original name, apparently, and this is maybe urban myth, but the original name was supposed to be the Independent Testing Authority. But the Swiss authorities, when they tried to register that name, came back and said, you're not independent and you're not an authority, you're providing a service. So, you know, it's a service provider, whereas the CADF, you know, and it takes time to establish an organization that's going to be effective in this area, because they're clearly sports specific. I think there's some merit in that, you know, in knowing the landscape that you're working in intimately. They've set up an intelligence and investigative unit just a couple of years ago. And again, these things take a while to bear fruit, I suppose. And it's not, you know, in terms of how they're able to communicate work they're doing, well, they're probably not able to communicate a lot of the work they're doing. But they do a lot of testing, 15,000 doping controls in 2018. They're, you know, pretty unusual in the world of sport, and cycling has really led the way in anti-doping in the sense, and what you hear about this organization is quite positive, no pun intended, but as you say, Daniel, at the same time, we don't know a great deal really about their work, and maybe that's the nature of an organization like this, that we're never going to know a great deal, especially about you know, cases that are perhaps you know, investigated and nothing happens, or riders that are given warnings, teams that are given warnings. There's an awful lot that we won't know about the work that they do, and some of it has to be based on trust, but we can only really have faith that they are, as you say, independent, and I think that's the key word here. And I think the fear with the ITA is that it's an arm of the IOC, and the IOC doesn't have a great track record in dishing dirt on itself. And I think within sport and in other Olympic sports, athletics are one, tennis are setting up an agency looking at match fixing and betting, athletics have their integrity unit. I don't think the IOC are very keen on independent organizations, whether it be in doping or betting, match fixing, integrity, that show those sports in a bad light. And it can look to some, perhaps, that the ITA is an effort to keep the anti-doping work kind of in-house.
Yeah, the anti-doping work is one thing, but the whole structure of the sports calendar and the way that the World Tour licenses are awarded and the way that wildcard places are allocated, these are things that directly affect the teams and the athletes. And it's very difficult not to sympathise with the teams when they say that they don't really have a great deal of representation when it comes to how these things are organised. The UCI's management committee meets and makes decisions and then hands down its verdict, and everyone has to go along with it. And really, when you look at the mess of the calendar, and this isn't something that's just happened overnight, you know, there has been some natural wastage, Daniel, as you say, and I think we do kind of focus on that early season part of the calendar just because of the way it's changed in the last 20 odd years since the start of the Tour Down Under in 1999 and races being added in the Middle East and being added now in Colombia and proving more popular with the World Tour teams than the traditional races in Spain, south of France and Italy. You do have to recognise that those races in Europe were struggling before events outside of Europe came along, and it's not that one has replaced the other. They may well have hastened the demise of some of those events, but one of the problems in Europe is that while it's possible to get road closures and have bike races take over towns for the biggest events, for smaller races that's becoming more and more difficult. And I think one of the other aspects of the AIGCP's criticisms of UCI is just the gaps in the way that safety of the riders is being implemented and really the emphasis of that being put on race organisers. I mean, when you have an event like the Binkbank Tour, which is in the World Tour, the Elite Series, having serious safety problems and being censured by the UCI for shortcomings, these are not, that's not a trivial issue. The safety of the riders is pretty much page one when it comes to the UCI's responsibilities. And so it's not difficult to see where the teams are coming from here. But the whole thing, as we've said many times before, and as we tried to address ourselves in an episode for Friends of the Podcast a few years ago, how could the calendar be made to make more sense? How could it work better for both the teams and the race organisers and the fans? And I certainly don't think that a sort of a 54 race second division is adding anything to the race calendar. I mean, it just makes it easier to kind of ignore those events at the expense of the World Tour races, of which there are probably too many as well.
Absolutely. Let's wrap things up for this week. We will, I'm sure, next week be talking at some length about the Richard Freeman hearing, which, as Lionel said earlier, is ongoing, and already some pretty juicy revelations coming out of that. I'm sure we'll know a lot more in a week's time, so we'll cover that next week properly, I hope. Before we go this week, just a little announcement. Our final Friends of the Podcast episode of 2019 will be coming out very soon. That's the one that's been suggested by one of our listeners, who's been guest editing it with me. That will be coming out in the next couple of weeks. And then shortly thereafter, we'll be launching our Friends program for 2020. And we have a new system this year for next year. It's much easier to operate. It's really, really, really great. It's just I'm just being given a gesture here. You just click a button, two clicks and you're in. Jonathan Rohr, head of Winning Behaviors, is sitting beside me here, just making sure I don't say the wrong thing at this point. But it looks great. Jonathan's been working hard on that, and we'll be launching that with a special episode on Egan Bernal and with a bit of a focus on what happened on stage 19 at the 2019 Tour de France, i.e. this year's race that was shortened. So we've got an interview with him and a few other people about him and about that day. So that will be episode one. We'll also have the audio version of our diaries from the Giro d'Italia, which is part of our new book. And the audio diaries will come out over the course of the year. The diaries will come out in audio form as well as being in the book. So that's all for this week. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich.